Tarry here, where the stories never grow old, and you hear something new every time they are told and it comes clear. So tarry here, where it doesn't matter your age, and when we gather round the table, we all take the stage year after year. So tarry here.
Welcome. You are listening to the Enlighten Radio Storytelling Hour at enlightenradio.org, broadcasting from Bolivar, West Virginia. How are you, Stosh?
I'm just fine. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, too. It's been a while. We've been gone for 2 weeks, I think, and I've missed everybody.
I do, too. But it's great to be back, and It's a new month, a new year.
It's 2019. Actually, we should tell our listeners, in case they're listening to the broadcast, to the podcast, rather than the live broadcast at the moment.
Well, that's true.
That it is July.
It's January, actually. And this should be put up. This broadcast should go on the air on January 7th.
I knew I shouldn't have had that schnapps for breakfast.
Yeah. So, this we're broadcasting January 7th, 2019.
Thank you. I think I am now anchored.
Well, anyway.
How was your new year?
It was wonderful and quiet and delightful.
That's good to hear.
Did absolutely nothing exciting except, nothing. We read, and I think I probably used my iPad and looked at things.
Are we talking New Year's Eve or New Year's Day?
Oh, New Year's Eve.
New Year's Eve.
Yeah. And then we did stay up and listen to the CNN host who I really like. Now I'm forgetting his name because my memory is gone quickly. And he.
Whoa! There's someone on a motorcycle at the door.
Anyway.
Go away.
Do you know who I mean?
No.
Goodness. He's the most. He goes into war zones and everything, and now he's. Anyway, he does the New Year's Eve broadcast from when they drop the ball every year, and he did it with a comedian, a female comedian, until like a year ago when she
She
made a joke about the president's head or something. And anyway, and he was tipsy. He and the guy who was doing it, a guy named Olson. That's funny, I remember his name. They were drinking and doing the broadcast, and he was tipsy, and I thought that was a little bit out of character for him since he's such a serious news guy and has been in war zones and stuff like that. But what are you going to do? You know, New Year's Eve. And I was amazed watching once again thousands and thousands of people. It was pouring down rain. They had slickers on and plastic things over their head and ponchos and stuff, standing there shoulder to shoulder, chest to back, thousands of people in New York, and they got all excited. And I thought, human beings are no more sensible than a bunch of chickens out on a farm, you know? It was like 1,000 chickens running around and going for the corn all at once.
Didn't you used to be excited by New Year's Eve, ever?
I get when I was a kid, people used to go out and fire a shotgun up in the air. New Year's Eve. I guess when I was young, I thought it was something, but it's just another day, and thousands of people to go to New York to get in the crowd, stand there shoulder to shoulder with people that you wouldn't. No, not. See, I don't understand crowds. I've never been to a professional football game or a college football game.
You know what? You should tell this as a liar's tale at the liar's contest coming up.
That I've never done it? Or that I don't get excited about it?
Well, I don't know. But I'm going to change the subject.
Okay. Liar's Tale. You going to be in a Liar's Tale?
I don't know yet. Well, the date might be problematic for me, but we'll see.
It's not possible.
Okay. Don't you tell our listeners about the Liar's Contest?
On January 18th at 8:30 p.m. in Sharpsburg, Maryland, at Captain Bender's Public House and Eatery, at 8:30 p.m. after the dinner hour, there will be a Liar's Contest and a $25 prize for the winner.
Oh, maybe I will have to compete.
There
then.
You go. That'll really help out. And this is the first time it's being done. I don't know if anybody has ever run a Liar's Contest in this area before, but certainly in Sharpsburg, it's not been done before. And we have a number of people signed up for it already. And I'm really looking forward to it.
I'm looking forward to it, too. And I do hope I can be there. But I will let you know in the next week.
I can't imagine anything that would keep you away.
All right. Well, we'll talk about that later.
Okay.
The theme of today's show is fresh start or fresh starts, depending on the story.
Sure.
And I'm looking forward to that, too. And I think both of us have some stories to share. But there was, I know, there's another storytelling event that I wanted to share. I will be doing a storytelling service at the Unitarian Universalist Church in Hagerstown on Sunday, January 13th at 10:45 in the morning. That's the usual time. And I won't be the service host, I don't think, but I will be doing the service speaking, the presentation, or the sermon, as they say in some churches. We don't usually say
that. Is there
that
a topic?
At the UU. Yes. I will be portraying T.H. Barnes, who is coming to give his views on life, death, and January.
Wow.
Is the topic.
Life, death, and January.
He had a lot of interesting things happen to him through his life in January. And they're kind of iconic, I think. But he also had a lot to say about the other two pieces of that title as well. And I'm looking forward to doing that. So you can call me for more information. You can also go to the UU website at uuhagerstown.org, I think is what it is. Or you can just Google Unitarian Universalist Church of Hagerstown. Call me, 301-730-1638. And if people want more information about the Liars Contest, they can go to Facebook.
Right.
I think it's posted on my Facebook page, Annie Crawford Storyteller.
Posted on mine also.
Very good.
And it's also on the Sharpsburg Facebook page.
Oh, very good. Also, and if they're in the neighborhood, can't they just go look at a poster?
Yes, there are posters.
At Bender's.
There are posters at Bender's, and there's a poster at the library, and posters at Victory Garden Ranch.
In Sharpsburg.
The place that supports veterans through their sales and stuff. And I think we should mention that the show opened with Andy Offit Irwin and the song Tarry Here.
Unless they're listening right now. Never mind. We'll talk about that later. I think we're broadcasting live at this very moment, is my impression.
Really?
Yes.
Okay, then I gave the wrong date.
Well, you gave the date for the podcast, for the official broadcast.
But if this is the unofficial broadcast.
This is the unofficial broadcast.
Then it's January 3rd.
That's right.
An auspicious day to have the first broadcast of the year.
Why is that?
It's a doomsday. Doomsday this year is on Thursday.
Okay.
And someday you're going to be able to recite all the dates of Doomsday for every year.
That's
yes.
not going to
That's
happen.
One of my goals.
Yeah. You're
to have you
die
learn that.
Unhappy, frustrated man. That's Never. All I have to say about that. Tell us a story, Stosh.
Oh, my goodness.
About a fresh start.
What's our topic? Oh, fresh starts. Well, fresh start. I have a number of thoughts about fresh starts. And since I was a teacher for 40 years, and I taught at a number of different schools and coached at different schools, sometimes coaching at schools where I wasn't teaching. And each time I changed schools, I thought of it as being a fresh start. Now, I'm not sure. Maybe the people at the school might have thought of it as being a good ending for them or something. But that's a topic for a different day. In 1967, I had just finished 1 year of graduate school studying chemistry at the University of Maryland, and I wasn't thrilled about graduate school at all. It was rather dull, unexciting. And I went to my high school where I graduated 8 years before that, and I applied for the soccer coach position. Unfortunately, it had already been filled. The man who had been my coach had died that summer, and they hired somebody, even though they had advertised in the paper for people to apply. They had already hired somebody. And I was in the office with Brother John, who was the vice principal, and he was looking at my resume, which didn't include any coaching experience, actually, but a lot of playing experience. And he said, "I'm sorry, but the job's filled, but I can offer you the chance to have a coaching position in the future and an assistance position this year if you would teach chemistry." And that was the first time anyone had ever said to me, "If you would teach chemistry." This was 8 years after I had graduated from high school. And so I really wanted to get involved in coaching, and I told Brother John I would take the position. Not everybody was thrilled about that, especially my wife at the time, because I was working at NASA and had been offered a job, full-time job there. And that day I called and turned it down because I had taken this chemistry position as a teacher, mainly because I'd be able to get on a soccer field. And there was a $2,000 difference in the job. And I'm guessing that you can all figure out which job paid less, working at NASA or teaching high school. So the very first day I went to the school for an official first meeting of the year with all the teachers and the administration, walking down the hall, one of the brothers who I had as a trigonometry teacher, Brother Joseph, called out, "What are you doing here?" And I walked into his classroom and told him I was going to be teaching chemistry. I was dressed in a suit and tie and everything, because that's the way you had to dress in this school as a student and a teacher. And he said, "You know, I remember you, and I didn't even think you graduated." I was not an outstanding student. I was a well-known student because I played on the soccer team and also because I was pretty active in other things. But I was not the kind of person who was blessed with lots of A's on his report cards. Not even blessed with a few A's on his report card. So anyway, my career as a chemistry teacher began in 1967, and the first day I stood in front of an auditorium with close to 200 students, and was introduced by Brother Kevin, who was the department chairman and who was also a chemistry teacher. We shared all the chemistry classes. He started to tell the kids a little bit about me, but he said, "Well, here, let's have your new teacher our new teacher introduce himself. And I hadn't planned on any introduction, and I walked up to the microphone and said, "Good morning, boys. My name is Mr. Z, and I'll be your chemistry teacher." And I hadn't planned on saying that, but for the next 40 years, I was Mr. Z in a number of different classrooms. And I truly, this was such a wonderful start, a really fresh start in education for me, because it was the single best setup in my mind for teaching the subject of chemistry. Brother Kevin and I shared a close to 400 students, a little under 200 in for each of us. We lectured to them twice a week. He did two lectures to his half of the class. I did two lectures to mine. And in the lecture, there were no questions allowed. It was strictly a lecture, very much like college. Then each one of us had a number of 25-minute question and answer classes. And each of the students attended those classes, and those classes were small, 12 to 14 boys in a class. So we had a very rigorous schedule. And in those small classes, the boys would walk in, sit down, and questions would begin. And that's the whole purpose of those classes, was to answer questions, illustrate how to do chemistry problems. And there was little, no lecturing whatsoever in that, just strictly question and answering, very much like a one-on-one session, even though it was about 12 or 14 boys. Each boy had three of those sessions a week. And then there were labs. Each of the students had a two-hour lab during the week. Our schedule was jammed. We were very busy, but I was so happy teaching that way. And I thought 3 years later, in 1970, when I was leaving that school, I had in mind that what a great career I had chosen. And as a young teacher with only 3 years' experience, I couldn't wait to go to another place. The reason I left was a personal reason. I didn't get fired. And I was looking for a job that would pay me substantially more money. So I applied to a public school system and got another job. But I kept thinking all that summer, this is going to be great. My first job was just terrific in my system. I couldn't wait to see what the public school system was going to be like. And for the next many years, I was disappointed in the system used by the public school, because it didn't really match the excitement and the intelligent way of having classes scheduled. In the first school I taught at, which was my alma mater, my own high school, we never missed a day. We had a schedule of days that were marked 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. And so if a hurricane hit the area and we had finished day 3 and we were off school for 3 days, 4 days, or any time, the next time we came back, we went to day 4. So no one ever missed a class. There was never anything like, oh, on Tuesdays we have this class, on Wednesdays we have this class. We just went 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 for 3 years. And that was wonderful. So that was a great start in education. And unfortunately, after that school, the systems that I got into offered other versions of a fresh start, which I never became enamored of. Always loved the classroom, almost never loved the administrations because of the lack of creativity, I guess. Anyway, that's my story of a fresh start.
Huh. I like that story. There's windows into your personality in that story.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
It's interesting. Did you have to wipe off the dust on the outside of the window to look in?
No, nothing like that. It's very interesting because I've heard versions of the story of you coming to the Christian Brothers School and versions of the story of you leaving the Christian Brothers School, but I had never heard the story of you starting in public school and had never heard about the scheduling Nirvana.
it's actually one of the disappointments of my life that no other school I taught at had such a beautiful, simple schedule. And unfortunately, even though I tried a number of times to institute that schedule, a schedule, mainly the going of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 and repeating. So, because so often in all the other schools I taught at, if Tuesday was a holiday, what was scheduled for Tuesday was missed. And Tuesday was a particular bugaboo with me because elections are always held on Tuesdays. And if you go through a typical public school system, you will find that Tuesdays are a day when odd things are put into the schedule, and so students often miss Tuesday classes. And as a chemistry teacher in a public school, there were often at least one laboratory class on Tuesday because we had lots of individual classes, and so they were spread out during the week. And so the students who had a Tuesday lab session missed that session and were behind. And so you couldn't keep things going very well.
Such empathy for your students. This is wonderful.
Well, I'm glad you think so.
I'm going to jump out of the, I'm going to take off my storyteller hat, though,
okay. And
put on my rebellious hat.
Oh, boy.
I guess it is. I don't know.
The hat I like most.
If you were going to explain from a public school administrator's perspective, what might be the downside, or even from your own perspective, was there any downside to the schedule at the Christian Brothers School?
There was none that I ever witnessed in 3 years, because in a school like that, it was a private school, a Catholic boys' high school. They didn't have anything in the county that had to be done on Tuesdays. There wasn't anything in the county system that, there was no system to interfere with them. It just didn't matter. On election day, they didn't have school in the high school I started at, but the next day just followed the next day's schedule, and it worked. But too many public school systems have all kinds of things on certain days during the week that interfere with the schedule. And kids have to do this on a Tuesday or that on a Tuesday or something. And it, I was often told, you worry about too many things like that. Just teach your classes. There was another reason. This is like people who are public school administrators listening to this program. Pay attention. Because maybe I shouldn't do that. the thing seriously was that in a private school, even a very large private school, there is a principal. If it's very large, there may be two vice principals. There will be a counselor. In a public school, there will be a department chairman, there will be a vice principal, there will be a principal, and there will be, in typical large counties, there will be a ratio of administrator to teachers, probably 1 to 6 or 1 to 7. So if just to make it simple, if the school system had 7,000 teachers, there would be 1,000 administrative positions in private schools. There may be 1,200 students and 5 administrative positions for 1,200 students. And they seem to work real well. Many of the private schools that I've worked in.
Do you think that's still the case now when there are many more requirements for everybody, including private schools?
They don't have requirements for administrators.
No, but they have requirements for paperwork.
Yes.
Okay.
But but I don't think it makes a difference to them. The private schools traditionally have always been able to be run by a few people, whereas the public school system, they always seem to find a need for another administrative position. There are just too many people sitting behind desks and in a central office doing lots of paperwork and in my not so humble opinion, just wasted people. Need more teachers, less administrators.
I don't disagree with you. I just don't see any way out of it. But
I think it'd be difficult for the systems to change. However, they could change. If they chose to.
The government would have to change.
The government would.
You sound like a libertarian right now.
I'm not sure.
That's not a bad thing.
I'm not sure. No, I don't take it as bad. I don't know if I would claim that as a title because I don't know all the things. What I am mostly for is to provide students with a good, solid education and to not have people sitting in offices shuffling papers because that has nothing to do with education.
Okay, so maybe one day on this program we will do a complete analysis of educational systems and talk about homeschooling and all of that.
Yes, yes.
Okay.
Yes. So, let's see, we should probably say something about...
The Enlightened Storytelling Hour and
yes.
EnlightenedRadio.org.
Go ahead. I've been talking, so why not?
Well, I just want everybody to know that we're broadcasting from Bolivar, West Virginia, and this is Fanny Crawford.
And Stasi Olkowski.
Your co-hosts. And this broadcast will officially meet the light of day or the fresh air of the world on January 7th, Monday, 2019. But it's possible you're listening to us live at this moment, and I'm not even going to tell you the time and day that is because you already know it. Anyway,
wow.
Our theme today is Fresh Start, and Stash just told a very interesting story wrapped or laced with politics, and it's really hard for me to leave that.
Yeah, well.
Without further analysis and discussion, but I think we've had enough of that.
We'll don't get me started.
Till another time. Okay, so we already told our listeners about the upcoming two-story events that we are most intimately involved in, the Liars Contest in Sharpsburg on January 18th. And the storytelling service at the Unitarian Universalist Church in Hagerstown on January 13th. Any other special events you think people should hear about? We can come back to that later, probably. Of course, the Speak Story Series in Shepherdstown and Stories in the Round in Hagerstown are both on hiatus. Both series finished their seasons back in December. And we'll soon be publishing teller rosters for the coming season, which begins in both places in March, second Tuesday of the month for Speak and fourth Monday of the month for Stories in the Round in Hagerstown. You looked like you were about to say something.
No, I'm fine.
Okay. You just looked like that.
Yeah.
I guess I'm going to try some storytelling here on the theme of fresh start. This story is called Fresh Feet. And we'll see what comes out. I can remember shopping for shoes with my mother every August before the start of school. Now, that tradition continued long after my mother actually handed over to me the responsibility of keeping myself in shoes. There was still that getting ready for fall feeling in my bones. But some of it was just tradition. August 1950, there's a photograph of me with my mother alongside a rowboat on a beach in upstate New York. She's in a pair of shorts and sandals, and my feet are in light-colored sandals, and my butt is in a diaper, and I'm just over a year old. She's holding me in that picture. Late fall, early winter, 1952. There's another photograph of me standing in front of the second house that we lived in after we moved from Chester, Pennsylvania, which is what at the time was a big industrial or small industrial city, to a first floor apartment near 40th and Girard Avenue in West Philadelphia. And my dad took this snapshot, apparently to preserve for posterity my plaid winter jacket, my snow jacket, and my corduroy snow pants, topped off by a child-size cold weather icon of a hat with a small bill. I guess that's to keep the snow out of my eyes. Fur lining, ear flaps, and a chin strap. There is no visible snow in this photograph. And in fact, I'm not wearing snow gear on my feet. It's a black and white photo. But they're dark, probably brown leather Oxfords on my feet. Such sensible shoes on a two-year-old. Photos of my girl cousins at this age showed them in crinolines and shiny black patent leather Mary Jane shoes with lacy socks spilling over the tops, dressed for birthday parties and church services. Whereas this picture is of unisex champion of something. I don't remember what I thought I was doing, but I have this resolute stance, and I think either my hands are on my hips or my fists are balled up like I'm going places or something. It's a very odd photo. August 1953. I'm standing in the schoolyard of the elementary school where I went to daycare for a couple of years. I'm holding the hand of my best friend. She's wearing a white dress and white shoes. I'm wearing a dress too. It's my birthday, my third birthday. And my dad came to visit bearing cupcakes with pale pink icing for the entire class. My feet are encased in what I now call Buster Brown sandals, because Buster Brown's the company who was making them when I started buying them for my daughter. She's 45 now, so that was a long time ago. But way back before that, there were other brands, and I don't think I ever had a pair of genuine Buster Brown shoes. The sandals in this photograph are dark, probably brown leather. My mother called them buckle shoes. And I did like them better than the Oxford. Some people call them sandals. Springtime, 1956. Now, maybe it started before that, but certainly by 1956, the first year I went to day camp on the other side of Parkside Avenue where we lived, what I thought of as deep in Fairmount Park, because it was behind Memorial Hall, And I never went there by myself at that age. We had picnics back there behind Memorial Hall. But it was not part of my freewheeling child territory. Now, Mom bought me what she called warm weather shoes. I called them Keds. Sneakers. Early on, mine were navy blue. The next year, though, I went to overnight camp for 2 weeks with a new pair of Keds. Probably navy blue. By the time I was 10 and going to camp for most of the summer, I had to have 2 pairs of Keds because I would have worn out 1 pair before I was ready to come home. All through the end of June and July, it wouldn't be until August that I came home so we could go on our family vacation camping in state parks through upstate Pennsylvania and across New York to visit my dad's family in Portville and Olean, Jamestown and Buffalo, New York. Now, by that time, they were making red and blue plaid Keds, and I had to have them. No more navy blue for me. The next year, I had a pair that were green denim. And the year after that, paisley. Red, blue, gold, and green swirls on a tan background. So stylish. And boots. Green rubber wading boots. Not hip waders, like fishermen wore. These only came up to my calves. But wearing them, I could tromp with abandon through puddles, across creeks, and through miles of wet grass hikes, following the camp nature counselor with a butterfly net or a number 10 can, perfect for catching tadpoles. And since I went to camp every summer, and as a family, we were tent camping 2 weeks every August, I almost always had a pair of those red or green puddle jumpers. Christmas, 1958. Grandma Rose sent me purple slippers with pom-poms knitted with her very own hands. They were lovely, but I used them to skate on our old narrow oak plank wood floors. Gave myself lots of splinters. And stopped wearing them when the splinters made holes in the knitting and wore those slippers out. The next year, Mom bought me lovely soft velour booties that came above my ankles, held in place with a loop of white elastic on each foot that wrapped around big shiny mother-of-pearl buttons. They had blue velour, kind of robin's egg blue velour uppers, and some kind of heavy white plasticky fabric for the soles. August 1960. Black and white saddle shoes with knee socks mostly, or red tights. I wouldn't wear ankle socks with any shoes except sneakers. Or years later, I once had a pair of loafers. August 1961, the year I turned 11, I managed to get my mother to spring for shiny black patent leather flats for a very special occasion. Now, my mother was the daughter, the oldest daughter, of a shoe shop manager, shoe salesman. And she was all about good shoes. Black patent leather flats did not meet her criteria. But it may have been because I was singing a hymn known as the African American National Anthem, Lift Every Voice and Sing, with my Girl Scout troop at our neighborhood AME Church, African Methodist Episcopal Church, a few blocks away. Whatever the reason, it still took a lot of cajoling and strategizing to get those black patent leather flats. Every other girl in my sixth grade class had access to black patent leather shoes, either sharing a pair with a sister, even if they had to borrow them from a cousin. But once I had them, I really didn't want to wear them that much. Mom was right. They were not very comfortable, and they were very, very, very shiny. Now, since my feet were still growing, it didn't take long before I really couldn't wear them. I jumped a full shoe size in less than a year. My school shoes that year were very clunky and heavy pair of beautiful black faux suede Oxfords with very round toes, thick rubber soles, and narrow black and white striped shoelaces. I loved wearing them with my new charcoal gray wool jumper with the contrasting red top stitching and my red button-down Oxford shirt. Too soon, all those new clothes and shoes were too tight. By Christmas time, I think. I remember feeling vaguely guilty, wondering if I was eating too much. August 1962, my first year in junior high school. Shopping with Mom, I picked out a pair of women's shoes. Caramel color wedge pumps that I wore with cable knit knee socks. I was only 12, but my feet were so big, it was too hard to find shoes for me in the children's shoe section. I could jump double dutch in those shoes, and I did most days after school. I'm going to stop there and take a break.
Okay.
Before I continue.
All right.
With this blow-by-blow story of my shoe history and a possibly surprise ending.
Okay. You're listening to EnlightenRadio.org, the Storytelling Hour at Enlighten Radio. EnlightenRadio.org.
Very good.
Right. From Bolivar, West Virginia.
And you know what? We haven't mentioned how to access podcasts yet.
I'm just going to say that.
Oh, good. Thank you.
TallTales.EnlightenRadio.org is where you go for our podcasts. And there are many, many podcasts, lots of them going back for a couple of years. And
several, yeah.
Yeah, and they all have themes, so you could go through them and see which one you like best. And
Sometimes there are guest storytellers.
Right.
Telling their stories.
And sometimes
check
the storytellers
out,
are guessing.
Yes.
So.
Everyone should check it out. Okay.
So at what age, I shouldn't ask this, maybe. What age did your feet stop growing?
Oh, they're still growing.
No, I didn't mean not spreading.
Not very much. I was up there. Wow. At least 18. I don't know.
Hmm.
I may get to that
okay.
in the story if it comes back to me. Hmm. Well,
I do have another announcement about storytelling.
Oh, please.
That is, it's just in the preliminary stages, but in another half hour, I hope it'll be firmly set. On February 9th in Sharpsburg, at my home, storyteller Jim May, who is an award-winning storyteller and author, his latest book, I think he has a new book coming out, but the latest one I have of his is Trail Guide for a Crooked Heart, and it is a marvelous collection of personal stories and some real insights into human behavior and some fun in it also. But Jim May is going to be doing a workshop at my home, and it'll be from 1 to 5 on Saturday, February 9th. And if you're interested in that, you could call me at 501-253-4656, and I would be glad to give you all the details about that. And I don't want to give the details on the radio right now because they could change by the time I get home. Yeah. And once we have it all down, then I can give details out. And and also, if you call me, I'll give you my address. Or you could write to me on email at stashtells@gmail.com. That's stashtells@gmail.com, and I will send you information. So, are you ready to go on?
I am. Okay, ready? I'm telling a story called Fresh Feet, and I'm up to 1965. August 1965.
Wow.
This is on the theme, our theme today of fresh start. I was working for a guy named David at the sandal shop on 17th Street between Walnut and Pine in downtown Philadelphia. The owner's business card said Cordwainer, David, the owner. I had to look that up. Quote, a shoemaker who makes new shoes from new leather. The Cordwainer's trade can be contrasted with the cobbler's trade, according to a tradition in Britain that restricted cobblers to repairing shoes. In ancient Britain, cobblers could only repair shoes, or if making shoes, used only used leather. Well, I never called myself a Cordwainer, but I was an apprentice. I was 14. My best friend's mother, a natural-born shopper who frequented the high-end shops and boutiques of Center City, Philadelphia, announced to her daughter and me that she had found apprenticeships for us both in a leather shop. We were astounded, speechless, literally. This was too cool, way outside our wildest dreams or any coherent image we had of the parental role. Now, we didn't make any money there, but David taught us enough skills to make our own sandals. My friend left after she made her first sandals, but I stayed for 2 years, made myself two pairs of sandals and another two pairs for friends, plus two small, beautiful leather purses from my mother. And then the couple who eventually bought the shop from David also dabbled in counterculture clothing. And the woman who's, I can't remember her name, but I thought she was beautiful with her tiny size 3 body and her waist-long black ringlets. I remember her husband's name for some reason. Bruce had long, curly, dark hair halfway down his back and a beard almost that shaggy, but I never thought him beautiful. She, however, saw me at least once weekly, sometimes several times a week, in a series of what I called Empire, or Josephine dresses that I made myself using a simplicity sewing pattern. Probably a dozen versions in all, different fabrics, ginghams mostly, but also wool, satin, and corduroy. She asked me for the pattern. I was surprised and told her the pattern number. But she persisted. She wanted to copy my paper pattern. I kind of resented that a bit. It was bad enough she was going to make a dress like mine. Then I came into the shop one day and saw one of my dresses, just like my dresses, hanging in the window for sale for $75. This was 1964, 1965, mind you. $75 would buy you a haute couture coat. I felt odd. It was a bit of jealousy, but something else. Annoyance, I guess. I wanted credit, some sense of acknowledgement that I had taught her something. She was very proud of the dress. She asked if I'd seen it in the window. But beyond telling me my dresses were pretty when she first saw me wearing them, that never happened. That, I think, was the beginning of the end for me at the sandal shop. David, the original owner, was long gone, moved to a farm someplace, I think. The new couple seemed to like me. They invited me to dinner at their house, and I went, but felt awkward and a bit uncomfortable. They smoked a lot of marijuana. They were happy to have me smoke with them, but they weren't really friends of mine. Mostly, they didn't seem to see me as their student, as David had. They would answer my questions about work, but they didn't look over my work or make suggestions to improve it. Well, August 1966, still under the spell of handmade footwear, I bought myself a pair of round-toed, handmade flat Oxfords of very dark brown leather with almost flat leather heels from the peasant shop at 16th and Pine Street in Center City. When I showed them to my mother, she said, "What on earth possessed you to buy those? I've been trying to get you into shoes like that your whole life. Why now?" She totally missed that they were so cool, because handmade in a loft in New York City, and therefore not as expensive as they would have been if they were actually good for your feet. She totally missed what she would have noticed if she had bought them, or had even been with me when I bought them, because she would have poked and pulled at them, and then poked and pulled at my feet in them. They were not all that comfortable. "No support," she would have told me if she'd looked a bit more carefully. If I tried to walk more than a mile in those shoes on concrete sidewalks, my feet would hurt for days afterwards. But they were perfect for hanging out in. May 1967, I went to my senior prom with a guy named Paul Van Horn. He wore a black tux with a blue cummerbund. I wore a green satin empire waist, ankle-length gown I made myself. Shoes dyed to match the gown were all the rage then. I think they still are. So I bought a pair of 2-inch heels from some company that did that, and felt glamorous and grown up for a few hours that evening. I never wore the dress or shoes again, but I hung on to both, and I still have that dress, though even saying that embarrasses me. December 1967. My first trip home to Philadelphia from Chicago was at Thanksgiving, and I must have been wearing something on my feet because it was cold outside. I can remember everything else I wore that week, my first trip home to Philadelphia. But the only memory I have of shoes at that time are the work boots I bought that first fall at a Goodwill store in Chicago, and those round-toed, brown, handmade Oxfords. In December, I came home again with my new boyfriend for the Christmas break, but we stayed in Philadelphia only a few days. We were off to Boston to visit friends that we knew from Chicago. And while we were there, exploring and walking and walking and walking and walking, we passed a small leather shop with high-end bags, shoes, and boots. And in the big front window of the shop, there was a stunning pair of navy blue lace-up, square-toed leather boots with metal lacing hooks up the front of the boot. I didn't have to think twice. I had something like $50, $75 in my purse from 4 evenings a week working on campus all semester. I tried on the boots, thrilled they had them in my exact size. Those boots served me well. From 1967 to the mid-90s, I'd buy them again in a flash if I could find a pair. I wore them with long skirts and short skirts. Loved, loved, loved those boots. Well, there's lots more shoe stories I could tell you. Every year in my memory is marked by some perfect pair of shoes, or not so perfect shoes, I found that year. But what I really want to get to is that I realized this week, thinking about my new great-nephew, born very, very late Christmas night, Marvin, they're calling him, Marvin Barnes Crawford Nares, for Marvin Gaye, with the middle name after my great-grandfather, Thomas Henry Barnes, and his hyphenated surname, Crawford Nares. Marvin's father doesn't speak Spanish, but Marvin's great-grandfather does. And maybe someday, so will Marvin. What I realized is this. I'm going to meet Marvin for the first time this weekend when I fly to California to spend a week with my niece and her husband, Marvin's parents. When I get there, I've decided I'm going to buy him his first pair of shoes. My feet are enormous. I wear a women's size 11. That's approximately a 9.5 men's shoe. Yet they are the smallest feet in my birth family. Maybe all of my lady cousins and their extended families, too. I drove 6 hours to a surprise 77th birthday party for one of those cousins in early November. There were maybe 60 of us there. I wasn't looking very carefully, but I do always look at everyone's shoes, especially at a semi-formal, elegant affair like that one. One of the cousins is a jazz singer. She brought her accompanist on keyboard, and they entertained us for almost an hour. They were good. And she took off her shoes. She took off her shoes to sing. I like that part best. So here's my second realization. We are a pretty practical group of women, this generation of lady cousins. But the one after us is even more practical, feet firmly on the ground. The four big-footed people I grew up with, Mom, Dad, and my brother, are practical people, all feet firmly on the ground. My brother is a doctor, a true believer in the scientific method. My mother was fond of telling the story of being called to jury duty four times and never seated as a juror. Librarians, she would say, never chosen. The bane of attorneys around the world. We believe in the facts, she would say. My dad managed kitchens, a cook for much of his life, not a chef, mind you. He fed soldiers and then worked in hospitals and children's homes and orphanages. He started a bookstore late in life, two of them actually, and ran them for nearly 15 years. Wore those wingtips to work every day till he retired and started wearing, in his 70s now, loafers, the shoes my mother never let me have. In my Mary Jane's plaid keds and strappy sandals, I was the mystic of the family. So when I go hunting for the right pair of teeny tiny baby shoes for my new nephew, after I get to know him a bit, I will be venturing out with a new generation. I can't wait to see those little feet.
Wow.
Is that the kind of story it was?
Well, it was very interesting.
If you like shoes.
Well, everybody should like shoes, I guess.
See, clearly you are not a shoe aficionado.
Oh, no. No.
Okay.
Well, the only time I ever really paid attention to shoes, two times in my life, in the Army, my shoes were always highly polished, taken care of. And as an athlete, as a soccer player, for 15-plus years, the night before a game, my soccer boots, we called them boots in those days, they were not as fancy as they are today, highly polished. Whoa. Teams I played for, I often had people shaking their head. They couldn't believe that I would take all the time to make sure my shoes were looking brand new when I stepped on the field.
Wow.
And it was because, to me, each game was a fresh start. And that's the way I treated it. I wanted to go into each game I played prepared just like the first game.
We're going to have another show all about shoes, because I know you have some more shoe stories.
I do.
They're tools for you. So I know you have more.
Yeah.
And I have all kinds of running shoes and work boot stories that I never even got to mention. But anyway.
Oh, boy.
It's time. We've reached the end of the road.
Are you going to close?
You're going to close.
Oh, I'm going to close. Yeah. Well, this is Stassi Olkowski and
Fanny Crawford,
your co-host for the Noontime Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour at enlightenradio.org, independent community radio in Bolivar, West Virginia. Closing out this week's show, the Storytelling Hour offers listeners a window into the world of storytelling by traditional and non-traditional storytellers. Excuse me. Encouraging our listening community to share, preserve, and expand all of our stories. Thanks for listening. Stay tuned for what's coming up next.